This week on Life and Faith.
They fly kites, yet they dance, yet they dream, yet the mothers still sing, and I have heard their song, and it sounds like hope, and it sounds like jubilation, and I do not understand it. Still joy resides here, where she should not be, there she thrives, more vibrant than anything.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. They just get their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. Now, what you just heard at the start of the show was performance poet Joel McKerrow, and we'll hear that whole poem later in the episode, so stick around for that. You won't want to miss it. It's stunning. In an earlier episode of Life and Faith, the writer Stephen Garber spoke about how he believes the artists, the musicians, the poets, the filmmakers, the painters, etc., kind of get there first. And they tell us what's going on in our culture. He said we'd do well to pay attention to them. And we like to hear from Joel McKerrow. Joel's been into CPX before. And he's been out and about lately talking about his most recent book, Woven. Now, this book is a spiritual memoir. It's an accounting of how Joel lost the faith of his childhood and the grief associated with that loss. But it's also about regaining faith. This time a more robust, holistic, richer version. So it's about restoration and rebuilding of broken things, whereby the rebuilt thing is much stronger and able to weather the storms of life. Now, Joel McKerrow is someone you can guarantee will be searingly honest, which is refreshing and attractive. He's been on quite the faith journey, so that's what I asked him about first.
So I grew up in quite a conservative church, a kind of conservative but also contemporary mainstream evangelical church. And I was a very passionate teenager during my teenage years. I very passionate about my faith and about God and about the world. And I'm still a passionate person, very much.
Yeah,
so.
That hasn't changed.
No, that hasn't changed. That hasn't changed. But I suppose what has changed in some ways would be what my faith looks like. So faith back then, the church that I grew up in, like faith was all about kind of your connection to God, your kind of personal individual relationship to God. And then to kind of be a moral person and a nice person and that kind of stuff outside of that. But for me, there was no sense of, in no way did I hear kind of talks about caring for the poor, about the refugee, about asylum seekers, about the earth, about the planet that we live on. Like, these were just the land that we grow up in. These were just things that I didn't hear about.
Yeah, so was it a bit, in a sense, now you'd look at it as more limited, both in terms of the faith, but the picture of God you were given?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. So a very, I don't know, black and white understanding picture of faith, that this is what it looks like. This is, if you are a Christian, then you believe this and you believe this and you believe this and you believe this and you do this that, and you do that and you do this. So it was kind of the fences. Mm-hmm. I know, I think it was Mike Frost talks and Alan Hirsch used to talk about sheep farming, that the way you can keep sheep in Australia is you either keep them fenced in,
yes,
or if you have a property that's big enough, you put a drinking well at the center of the property and then you don't need the fences.
Uh-huh.
And so they were kind of talking about that as two different
image.
Ways of understanding. Yeah, an image of understanding kind of Christianity and the church, that for some Christianity looks like these are the fences. This is, you need to believe this doctrine and you need to do this. You need to fit into this culture and that kind of thing. But perhaps actually, is there a different way, which would be the drinking well at the center that therefore
draws you in.
Yeah.
Now, part of your awakening was to come to recognize the sort of the all-consuming nature of whatever context you grow up in.
Yeah.
Now, What were the most formative experiences that gave you a different perspective on that culture? Because you had a couple, didn't you?
Yeah. There were a number of, so I kind of call them inciting incidents is what in kind of narrative theory and stuff in, I do a lot of, I'm a poet, so I do a lot of writing and storytelling, and they always talk about the inciting incident, that you have life as normality and then kind of it's the thing that happens that kind of kicks the story in. So for me, there was a number of things that kind of shook up what I would call my my fishbowl. One of my favorite sayings in the world, a fish in a bowl doesn't know that it's wet. Yeah. That helped me to look back upon the fishbowl that I'd been swimming in. There's a whole bunch of them. One of them was going along to a drop-in center. A friend of mine invited me along to a drop-in center for street workers, for girls off the street down in down near Wollongong, where I grew up. And I remember going in, and I'd never been in that context before, ever. The girls would come in and they'd have a meal and have a shower and get cleaned up and that kind of thing. And before they go back out on the street again. And I remember washing dishes with one of the girls afterwards, and I write this in my book, and standing there and thinking, you know, this is the first time, like me as a Christian, this is the first time that I've spent any time with the people that Jesus spent all of his time right. with. And it was one of those very self-confrontational moments where I was like, I'm not a Christian. Like, I'm not a Jesus follower. I'd go to church. I do all the churchy things. But in terms of if I was actually following Jesus, how could this be the first time that I've ever spent time with the people Jesus spent all of his time with? So as though I have a number of different experiences where it was like the blindfolds were taken off my eyes, and I was like, ah, okay. I have been living in a fishbowl, in a bubble, and my world and my Christianity has been so shaped by that safe, comfortable, white, middle-class fishbowl that I have not seen the reality of the world around me.
Mm. It's sort of everyone's experience to some degree, isn't it? Like, yeah. you can't kind of be blamed in a way for whatever fishbowl you happen to grow up in. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so getting out of that, seeing the perspective of other people is key, right?
Yeah.
So it's at least having some sort of experiences beyond the one you've been brought up with and getting a bit of a perspective on it.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you did become a bit disillusioned.
I did, yes.
And you found yourself in something of a spiritual wilderness.
Yeah.
Was that a liberating experience for you, or was it a traumatic one?
It was probably both. Yeah, both. Which I think it is for a lot of people. It's kind of this freeing thing of... it doesn't have to be so constricted as I thought it was. But within that, there's a lot of fear. Like, am I just going off the deep end? Am I falling into? There's a lot of labels we give people who go through times of what do we call it? Wrestling, struggling, deconstruction is kind of one of the cliche kind of phrases we say around it. But things like backslidden and fallen away and kind of, and so there's all these things of like, am I just going off the deep end? Am I just losing myself and losing my faith? And I kind of again and again I kept coming back to actually my faith is getting larger, like it's getting stronger and bigger. It looks really different to the church that I grew up in and the faith of my parents and that community. But it's something that is mine now, and I'm beginning to own it. So it was both a difficult, eye opening, freeing. Hard experience, yeah.
Now, one realization that you had that I found interesting was your sense that the Jesus you knew as a kid had been kind of domesticated.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He looked a lot like the people you were surrounded by. Yeah. Now, what's wrong with that picture, though?
What's wrong with the domesticated Jesus picture? Yeah. I think I write about it in the book, actually, with the thoughts of... I remember the WWJD bands, What Would Jesus Do bands, and kind of a fad.
I always thought that was a bit presumptuous to assume you'd know what
well,
Jesus
this is
doing.
This is the...
Because he was quite confounding, right?
That's right, yeah. And I think when I was asked, as a teenager, like I wore those bands and I would ask myself, what would Jesus do? But I was asking, what would the cultural Jesus that I know of do? What would my perspective and understanding of Jesus do? And my Jesus, I realized, was a very safe, white Jesus that didn't speak to the...
Shined his shoes and you know, got to things on time.
Possibly. But more like a Jesus that didn't speak to, say, the economic inequalities of our time. That when I went back to the Gospels, back to the Bible and read them, it was a Jesus who stood up against kind of the systems of military might, of power, of oppression, of dominance.
Yeah, I was interested in that because you talk about him subverting things that I think largely he just ignored. So the military power, the kind of might of Herod, those sorts of people. I see less a very active subversion of him, more a kind of, that's not what he's on about. It's very clear he's not interested in that type of thing. So yes, I saw it less subversive. It's less the kind of revolutionary Jesus that sometimes people like to kind of put on him as well.
Yeah, well, I think it's both. Like, we spiritualize Jesus a lot, even the terms of Jesus. And so one of the terms often that we will say Jesus is the Son of God. And we kind of see that as a spiritual term, but if you go back to the ancient history, to the coins of the day, it was on the coins of the day was Caesar Augustus, the emperor, the Caesar of the time, and the coin said Caesar Augustus, the Son of God. So it was actually a political term, and so Jesus owning that term for himself and saying, yes, you can call me the Son of God, was not just a spiritual.
It's a very provocative thing.
It's a very provocative. Yeah. It's the kind of thing where if any of the Roman soldiers had been nearby, then Jesus trouble. Would have been lost to us earlier. Jesus would have died earlier, not just being put up on the cross at that point. But even the putting up on the cross was the execution for subversives, for political insurrectionists. And so it was that, but it was also so much more than that as well. It wasn't just that Jesus was bringing about a new political reality and saying, no, I should be Caesar. It was actually something much greater of I have a kingdom of God,
right?
Yeah, I have a kingdom. What's a kingdom? A kingdom is the king's domain, the domain of the king, the society of the king. I have a new way of actually being human and society together under the reign of God that looks like equality and justice and all the things that Jesus lived out, the caring for the poor, the bringing together the oppressor and the oppressed around a common table together.
One of the things that you talk about that you came to understand Christian faith as being a lot more than simply individual salvation.
Yeah.
So that's a point. Yeah. But it is also that, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that it's about our relationship with God in the sense of my connection to God that begins in the here and now and splays out into eternity. So even those words, eternal life, is the, I'm not going to be able to phrase this correctly, but in the Greek is the word zoe aeon, which is kind of, aeon is where we get our eon term from, eons. It means life of the ages, life to the full, that begins in the here and now and plays out into eternity. So it's actually about kind of holistic, it's about my connection to God as well as my connection to people, at a micro level and at a macro kind of economic level, social level, and about my connection to the earth and to creation and my connection to myself as well. So that's what life to the full is. Absolutely, it includes my spiritual connection to God, but it's bigger than that as well.
This is Life and Faith from CPX, and I'm speaking with performance poet Joel McCarrow. Joel has a book out, it's called Woven. It's about losing the faith of his childhood, but regaining it in a more holistic, vibrant form. Interestingly, it was delving into the past that helped Joel re-engage in the present. When you talk about your sort of unraveled self, as you move kind of away from, or at least a different version eventually, of the faith of your childhood, what was that person like to be around?
The unraveling, I had you could ask my parents about that and they might tell you. I remember some large arguments with my parents. It was a lot of pointing of accusatory fingers. It's quite a, I think that kind of time of life of unraveling is, there's a lot of ego involved in it as well, where you're trying to work through stuff, but you're doing it in a way that's, I was young, like I was whatever in my late teens and early 20s and stuff. So I was caught up in that kind of time of my life. But so there was a lot of arrogance and a lot of hypocritical black and white conservative. And so there was a lot of pointing of accusatory fingers.
Yeah, and you came to have a much more generous view of that part of your life now, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the journey is, and what I see with so many of my friends and so many people is that we get stuck in that unraveled, in that critical thinking desert, someone called it. Mm. And we need that. We need to be asking the questions and being critical and challenging and unraveling and deconstructing. But we also, part of me, and this is kind of the title of the book, is Woven, is this movement from all those unraveled threads, being able to kind of weave them together in a way that's able to hold the complexities, to not have to throw, the way that I phrase it is, you don't have to throw the baby of faith out with the bathwater of cultural Christianity.
Yeah.
That you maybe absolutely challenge and question and work through and come to your own understanding, but don't, because sadly, like 60-80% of young people throw the faith out by the time they hit 24. They leave it all together. And the church is not journeying well with those people at all. And so I did come to I think the journey is how to do that healthily and how to do that well, that time. It's those times, because we all go through unraveling times in our lives again and again and again as different stuff happens in our life. But I absolutely came to a point where I was like, oh, actually, there's so many beautiful things that I learned from my sculpting community, from that nurturing community that I grew up within. And so there's a bunch of stuff that I kind of left behind and a bunch of stuff that I held onto and kind of became a new weave for me. So it's holding together of what I would call kind of traditional answers and emerging questions.
Yeah. And funnily enough, it was really something from the tradition, in a sense, that was very helpful for you in reconnecting. You were looking at kind of Celtic spirituality and some sort of spiritual writers, some Catholic, some Protestant, but you were delving back into the past in order to deal with this change.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of like I had my the small tradition that I grew up in. Then going back to the ancient tradition for me was like, oh, actually, I, because of those fears of like, am I just going on out on my own, out into the wild desert on my own, to find the way that I phrase it in the book is a tradition that I could belong to, that all these things that kind of didn't fit within my church growing up and my community growing up around connection to the earth, around our relationship with the earth and economics and kind of contemplative spirituality and all this kind of stuff that just didn't fit there, that I kind of owned. Suddenly I had a language to speak of them. It was like, oh, all this stuff, I can actually name some of this stuff in me now. This is okay. Like there's a tradition behind me that holds Christianity, that looks Christianity, that Christianity looks like this. And that's what I was able to come back to and hold on to. And it's the thing that I would say helped me to reconstruct my faith and my life and to hold on to my Christianity. Though it may look different to my upbringing, what it looks like now is so wonderful that I'd never want to leave it.
One thing that's very clear in your work, you're a poet, you're sort of a feeling kind of person, but you're great.
It's a lovely way to put
it seems we have this weird kind of hard materialism going on in our culture now, where people are very uncomfortable or find difficult to put into words or even start having good conversations around transcendent things. Is this something you must notice this and find it bemusing, do you?
In some sense this is the job of the poet, and this is why I love being a poet, is because poetry is about bringing words to what, kind of articulating what can't be articulated. In terms of transcendent and things beyond materiality, I think that is where the creative artist comes into it. Science can kind of speak to the material realities of our world, and theologians, I suppose, speak to the spiritual realities, and the best probably bring those together as well. But I think the job of the artist and the creative artist, the poet, is to bring those two things together. The materiality, playing with words and writings on a page, or the painter.
That is physical.
That's right. Yeah, the painter painting.
But it feels like something beyond that too.
That's right. It's holding together the invisible and the visible, and not letting those go.
What's your experience with young people? I know you work with young people a lot in schools and college age sort of people. What's your sense of where they're at in being able to kind of connect with this sort of thing?
There's probably two things I'd say. One is because our fish, one of the fish bowls that we swim in is consumer individualistic society. There's a very instant gratification kind of spirituality that most young people have. And so if it's not this instant, like if I can't have this instant experience, if I can't open the Bible and find something that's going to instantly amaze me or whatever, then it's like, oh, I don't, whatever. Yeah. So I think there's that sad thing that happens. But I think also young people are beginning to maybe see the frailties of some of the social systems. And I mean, there's so much dissatisfaction in our young people around our political systems and our social systems today. And even though they're still caught up in kind of the consumer social system, there's a beginning to recognize that it doesn't actually bring the fulfillment that it promised, and that our political and social realities are not bringing about, like, for instance, all the amazing young people that marched the other day in terms of the climate change and wanting our government to do something about the climate and our policies around that. Like, that's a whole bunch of young people that are choosing to that are being dissatisfied with what they're seeing and saying, we want to see something different, which is really encouraging. Like, that's a huge thing.
Now, you became, I think, and I think you remain somewhat suspicious of absolute truth claims. Mm-hmm. Because you say that truth is larger than we can comprehend. Or fair enough. But Christian faith does rely on some pretty big truth claims, doesn't it? So what hope is there of accessing that kind of truth that Christianity is on about? How do we go about that, for instance?
Sure. So I would say, for me, I actually see it in a really positive sense that I think we have finite brains. And so when we say something like God is love, we understand like the very skim of the ocean of that. Yeah. And that's a truth. God is love. But my personal understanding of that really is so small, so tiny. And so it's not that I don't think we can come to an absolute truth because we bring our own bias. There's no way we can get away from our own prejudice. I don't think that's therefore saying, well, just whatever goes.
There is no truth.
That's right. Yeah, you go your way, I go my way. We'll believe whatever the heck we want together. But actually it's I think it's Brian McLaren who talks about it as a multiplying of perspectives, that if I come to you with and say, this is my understanding of God, and I deeply listen, not just to try to, often when we listen to people that we...
You're getting ready to tell them where they're wrong.
Well, yeah, that's right. But actually listen, then it actually grows my understanding of God. And so it's not that I would say, if God is love, it's not that God... Let's phrase it mathematically, which as a poet is just genius, isn't it? It's not that God can be anything from zero to infinity. God is not hate, I would say. God is not that kind of thing. But what I would say is between zero and one, there is an infinite number of integers. So if God is love, the infinite nature of that means that I can discover that again and again and again and again and again and again and again in different ways beyond my own small perspective and cultural perspective and biases. And so that is both a humbling thing and it calls me into a deeper richness of God.
So there is a humility required even at the point of where we're feeling convinced of certain things, because there's a sort of rich in the positive, there's a richness to me hearing a bit more of your perspective, you're hearing a bit more of mine, right? Now, you have a lovely way of describing life's joys and wonders, but also the pain and sorrows being woven together, sort of life and death, really.
Yeah.
How do you think we best deal with that reality?
Holding, it's what I call kind of the aching pain and the delicious hope of our lives. Actually, I don't call that. It's stolen from Ronald Rollheiser, but I love those terms and I use them all the time, that we... many of us, we get really fixated on the delicious hope side of life or the delicious hope side of Christianity or whatever, and we kind of ignore the aching pain. And for some of us, we get so fixated on the aching pain that we forget the delicious hope, we go into kind of victim land and despair world. And I think how we hold those together is actually in the midst of despair, in the midst of the dark times, in the midst of the darker realities that we see in our world, it's searching for light until we find it, because the light is there. I talk about in a poem of mine, maybe I'll perform it in a second, share it with you, how we don't take the light into the darkness. we actually find where the light is in the darkness, that the light is there. That if we have in Christian world, there's a doctrine of the omnipresence of God, that God is present in everything. And again, I think it's a doctrine we say cognitively, but we don't actually live out or recognize. But if God is present everywhere, then God is present in the midst of the darkest realities. And I think our job, both as a Christian, our job as me as a creative artist, as a poet again, is to kind of stare at the darkness until I can see the light. And to refuse to let go of either, not to ignore, not to, because I think we need to write our, as a poet, I need to write the lament poems. I need to get angry. I need to yell at God and yell at our world. And I also need to write the poems that say, even in the midst of this, there is hope.
Well, light in the darkness is a lovely way to think of this. Thank you so much for coming in, Joel.
Yeah, my pleasure. There is too much pain here. Have you seen it? Or not seen it as much as felt it? Let the broken wrap around you like chain, like heavy chain, like sorrow. There is too much sorrow here. It gets under your skin and in your eyes, a dark lens, and everything seems hopeless these days. Everything seems hopeless. The little girls taken as sex slaves, a suicide behind detention center fences, a black man shot, a little boy washed up on a beach, a wife beaten, the president, his grabby hands, and how we just bluff off abuse from those who are in power, the incarceration of color, and always, always the starving children, or the people that my government still keeps imprisoned on an island called Nauru. Sometimes I don't know what to do. Despair is an absence, and I can feel useless in its blankness. And yet, friends, my daughter still makes me smile. And my son, he makes me laugh. Yet the girl who was raped, on the day that I met her, she would not stop giggling and tickling her brother, both of them lost in a rapture deeper than I could ever know. Yet the girl with the HIV scabs all over her body and the dirty streets of Kampala, she would not stop laughing and pulling faces at me, her revelry, a refusal in the face of the disease that burnt through her body. Yet the boy in Burma who had just seen his family shot, he still loved to play paper, rock and scissors. He would beat me every time. Yet the children still chase each other daily through the bombed out buildings of the broken city. They do not realize, so they do not let the delight die. Yet they fly kites, yet they dance, yet they dream, yet the mothers still sing, and I have heard their song, and it sounds like hope, and it sounds like jubilation, and I do not understand it. Still, joy resides here, where she should not be. There she thrives, more vibrant than anything. So if these fractured friends, if they may still smile, then I too must find a place of gladness, lest I deny them the delight they have to feel. I too must hold hands with delight and kiss the extravagance, to revel in this existence, to not despair, to see that beauty, she is everywhere, folded deep into every dark thing. So may our lives be a chasing of the beautiful, not a taking of the light into the darkness, but recognizing she already resides there. So let us chase the light and find the light and taste the light and dance the light, become the light, even in the night when the sun is cast upon a heavy, heavy moon. Friends, do not despair, for this light, this joy, this love, they are everywhere, folded deep into every dark thing.
That was Joel McCarrow. He's a performance poet and writer. You can find him at joelmccarrow.com, where you will also see his latest book. It's published by Acorn Press. It's called Woven. It was good to be with you again on Life and Faith. My name's Simon Smart. If you enjoyed this episode, please do pass it on to others that you think might like it and encourage your friends to join the Life and Faith community. We'd also love you to leave us a rating or review. It helps get the word out. Next week.
It was so lonely, so scary. It was like my teenage brain couldn't comprehend the consequences and the adult nature of what I was looking at on this pregnancy stick. Like my nana had taught me that if something really bad happened, that you'd say, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, help me." And I remembered before that second blue line began to appear, I think I said that a million times.